Welcome to the Wealthy Speaker Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to people who want to speak more as a way to build their income and grow their business. Hey, well, welcome everyone to the Wealthy Speaker Podcast. I'm Jane Atkinson. Actually, it's a video podcast today. Very exciting. I'm Jane Atkinson, your host and the founder of the Wealthy Speaker University. Now, today's show is brought to you by our Wealthy Speaker Acceleration Course. I'm not going to say too much about this because I have my guest expert standing by and I can't wait to talk to him, but I will say that we now are offering three different ways for you to move through the program. So if you're that type of person who does not want to be in a group, you want to do a DIY, no problem. We've got that. If you're someone who actually wants a fair amount of coaching, we've also got some options on that. So hop on over to wealthyspeakeru.com. If you are a new speaker, you're frustrated, and you would like to get going just a little bit faster, we would love to see you over there, and we'll have a little strategy session to talk to you about. Now, one of the things that we do in our program is developing content. How do we develop content? How do we become a content machine? And our guest expert, Scott Ginsburg, is indeed a content machine. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you. Nice to see you again, Jane.
I'm so glad. You know, I'm doing this one for purely selfish reasons, Scott, because I'm in the middle of a big project. And, you know, I feel like I have two speeds, off or like full on.
Sure.
And sometimes when I get turned off, I need a little inspiration to kind of get it going around. And I think you are the perfect guest to kind of get this whole content machine rolling again. So let me just share with everybody, Scott, the one paragraph bio that you shared with me.
Sure.
Because this is hilarious. It blows me away. Since 1999, Scott Ginsburg has profitably created 35 books, 8 musical albums, 3,000 articles, 600 speeches, 88 training videos, 5 software applications, 3 music films, 1 game show, and a globally recognized brand on approachability. He is also the world record holder for wearing name tags. And I think that's a great place to start, Scott. You know, I know the story behind the name tag, but why don't you share that with everybody as a starting point here today?
Sure. So this story was 6,374 days ago, which is about 18 years. And when I was in college, I had this idea to wear a name tag just for fun as like a social experiment. And literally the minute I put a name tag on and started walking around campus, people treated me differently. And I felt seen in a way that I had never felt before. And I treated other people differently and I saw people differently. And it really just sort of transformed the whole dynamic. So not having any ambitions of being a career out of that, I just decided to continue wearing a name tag for fun. And then it went viral on campus, just sort of word of mouth, pre-technology. And then I decided to write a book about it, which later went viral for real on the internet. And here I am, you know, a couple decades later, still doing this stupid thing. And, you know, I'm on to my second career now, which is pretty exciting.
Well, what I love about this is that you picked this lane of approachability. You teach people, and approachability has so many outcomes.
Right.
It could be a sales outcome. It could be a workplace outcome. It could be a college outcome. I mean, there's a million different ways that you can apply this.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's all come back to the same thing. What do you think the value for those people who are still kind of fighting against the idea of picking a lane? What do you think the value of becoming known for one thing has been for you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think that you can debate it either way. I mean, there's some times when I don't want to pick a lane and I want to do other stuff. So let me answer this question with both sides.
Okay.
I think in the beginning, it's important to pick a lane because it differentiates you and it gives you some constraint. I think if we've learned anything from the art world is that constraints are what enable creativity and innovation. So from that standpoint, I'd say it's really important to do it early. But at the same time, one of my mantras is no labels, no limits, which I know is ironic because I am the label guy, literally. But I think that we have this this mental block where people who are creators of some kind, they think, well, I can't write a book about X because I'm the guy that does Y. But I don't buy that. I think that there is no content police going to beat our door down to the station if we choose to do something that's outside of our lane. I'll give you an example. I mean, I've written 36 books, and the last one I did was about yoga. Okay, so, and I'm really proud of it. I worked really hard on it, and it's a book I wrote for my yoga studio, for our community, because as a volunteer, I wanted to create this product for our business. And the word name tag does not appear a single time in that book. And it only took me 35 books to get to that point to write a non-name tag book. But like, we have to give ourselves permission to do that. Like, it's pick a lane for sure, but like, don't be afraid to, you know, turn on the turn signal and, you know, switch over to another lane and see how it feels. Because look, we're grown-ups, we're adults, we can do whatever we want.
See, you're doing that, I would say, more as a charitable endeavor. You wanted to give back to your yoga studio.
Yeah.
It may not be that you're going to be on national TV talking about yoga tomorrow. And that's kind of the idea that I understood once I wrote my frog book, which was about love and dating. I recognized that I didn't want to be known. I didn't want to be doing that 24/7 in the way that you need to do in order to really create a best-selling book. And so I think if you have all the information and you make a decision, that's great. I think it's a lot of people just don't have all the information. And that's what we're here to give them.
Yeah. And I think it's
hard. We made the mistakes.
I know. I think it's hard in the beginning to pick that lane because you don't have the information. And this really comes back. This is not about being a speaker or a writer or anything. This is about decision-making. And this is something I get really angry about this because I have a very particular way that I make decisions. Mm-hmm. And so it frustrates me when people don't think like me. I don't know if you have that issue too, but I'm like, why aren't you more like me? Damn it. But there are really struggling decisions. They want perfection. They want all the information. They want clarity and certainty and closure. And those things don't always come. So my recommendation to people is the path that you choose is the right one.
It's the one that you're meant to be on because ultimately it's going to teach you something, even if it's an epic fail, right?
Totally. And that doesn't make it not right. Just pick something.
Okay. So we're talking about the building of a content machine. You have been an absolute machine now and on an ongoing basis. Are you like me where you're kind of either all in or off? Do you have like a medium mode for your machine?
I didn't used to. But once I started having stress-related injuries and was hospitalized multiple times for my workaholism, I realized that it's actually okay to have a dimmer switch. It's okay to not be all in or all out all the time. So initially, no, it was black and white. But now the yoga book is a really great example. So, you know, this is a project that I've been slowly working on for, I don't know, 10 years. I would just write a little bit about yoga here and there. I was like, yeah, I'll do a book eventually. And then when I got an offer from a publisher and I had like half of it done, they said, hey, can you finish the next half, you know, by February? I'm like, yeah, sure. No problem. Then I had to get in a little more than I usually did. But like, I am what you would call an incrementalist. Okay. I think that's really important to my own success as a writer is I just do a little bit a day. Like, you know, I have a full-time job. I work at a startup as the head of, and I also call it a dual citizen. So I was up this morning and I wrote a page this morning. That's really great. I don't know what book it will be in. It'll come out eventually. And then I like commuted to work and got on with my life. So
okay, we are having a little delay. So I'll apologize for anybody who's noticing that on the technology. So tell me what you work at. This, what's the startup and what are you the head of? Cause that blanked me.
Yeah, no problem. So I work at a company called the Metric Collective.
Okay.
And it is a startup in New York that acquires, incubates, and builds technology companies. And my job on the digital side is the head of content. So I run the blog, I do all the editorial, I interview people in the office to pull insights out of their brain because they don't like to write, but I do. I work on branding, I work on partnerships, a lot of different stuff. So I have a 9-to-5 job and I still write 3 to 4 books a year. That's like a couple pages a day. And so you don't have to be all in the way that you think you do.
Okay, I'm loving this. And I'm going to get into your methodology and kind of different ideas for people on how to write and when to write and that type of thing.
Sure.
Let's talk about the 3 stages of building a content machine.
Sure. So I like to think of it, I do a lot of yoga, as I mentioned, so I'll just use that as an appropriate metaphor.
Okay.
So let's think about the breathing process, okay? There's 3 steps to breathing. There's inhale, and there's a pause. If this is your diaphragm, that's the pause, and then exhale.
Okay.
So I treat the creative process along those 3 levels. So inhaling, which may also be called inspiration, which is you need to breathe in experiences and ideas and inspiration and life. So that is the fuel, the build. And the pause is usually the place where most people screw up. It's what most people overlook. Not only in breathing, people are scared to pause because they think like their heart is going to stop, but it doesn't. But in writing too, the pause is that organization. And it's that taking a step back from all your ideas and trying to figure out, what does this want to become? What type of media could I use to express these ideas?
Are you saying clarity is a piece of this formula, Scott?
Well, clarity is not guaranteed in life, but it's good work if you can get it.
Okay.
And then the last part is exhaling, which is the publication, the creating it and getting it out into the world. So it's, you know, that's the marketing side, which people love doing. And there's people that are great marketers, but crappy writers. There's people that are, and that unfortunately is not a problem, because if you're a great writer and the writing is mediocre or crappy, you're going to like do really well. And that bothers me because I'm a good writer. But then there's people that are amazing writers, but terrible marketers. And that breaks my heart because their work doesn't get out into the world. But if you can do both of those and also have some organization and some clarity in the middle in terms of sort of a left brain structure to it, that's like the Venn diagram of writing that it does 100% work regardless of your personality and sort of a working style.
I just want to note that I think you've taken a little of New York on to you. You're like, yeah, this really bothers me and this really bothers me.
Oh, yeah.
Who you were before, Scott.
No. Apparently anger is a really healthy emotion to have. As long as you can...
Survival in Brooklyn.
As long as you can channel your anger productively, it's a good thing.
Oh, that's funny. Okay. All right. So we've got inspiration, organization, and then publish. That's kind of the 3 stages for building this content machine. What do you think people use as excuses for not creating content?
Oh, man. Where do we begin? I mean, there's always the time excuse. And before I start listing excuses, let me say I have heard and probably made every excuse in the world. So like the more excuses people have, the less likely I am to try to encourage them to do anything. Cause I'm like, they're not in a position to listen to me. I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't fix you. Like it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So I just to put that frame around what I'm about to say. So yeah, like no time. I don't like writing. I'm not good at writing. I don't have anything to say.
And so
let me take a few of those. I don't like writing. Okay. So I totally respect that because, you know, I work in an office with 20 people. Okay. And my job as head of content is even if someone doesn't like writing, I don't care. Like right. My job is to take what's here and then, you know, what's here. I want to pull it out of you. So there's plenty of people in my office that don't like writing, but they're really smart. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, you don't like writing. Do you like talking? And if they do, great. We'll sit down. I'll interview them. I'll record it. I'll get it transcribed for 10 cents a minute. And then the content is done. That, you know, subverts that excuse. Or if they don't like talking, we'll jump onto Slack and we'll instant message back and forth all week. And I'll put questions out and I'll turn that into their content. Like there's ways around all these excuses people have. And I think what it goes back to is a definition. So when it comes to writing or insert here, thing you don't like writing, creating content, et cetera. Well, how do you define that? Because people think that writing is defined as like, I have to type, I have to put words on a paper. Not necessarily. All it is taking what's here and getting it out there. And there's a million ways to do it now.
Do you have good ideas? That's maybe the question. And how do you want to share your ideas? And I think nowadays, if you are adverse to writing a blog every week, then you do a podcast or you do a vlog or whatever. There's a lot of different ways to get your content out. So as the content machine, you've done all of those things.
Yeah. And even, you know, your comment to do you have good ideas? I would even say the word good is a dangerous excuse because that becomes a judgment too. I think our job is to judge later in the process. Mm-hmm. Like, do you have, forget if you have good ideas. Do you have bad ideas? I have tons of bad ideas. I built an entire game show out of my horrible ideas, and it is like the most fun project I've ever done. So don't label it. It's not good. It's not bad. It's not useful. Just get it out.
I love it. Okay, so let's go circle back to the time excuse. I think probably the majority of my, we'll call them like intermediate to upper end speakers, they're just struggling to find the time to create. Let's say they need to write a book and I'm just busy speaking on the road all the time and that's really taking up all of my time and I can't carve out the time. Let's speak to that.
Okay. So, I mean, let's go back to the original assumption is I have to write a book. So the word have, H-A-V-E, is a dangerous word. I have a list of dangerous words that I've been writing. I'm going to grab my phone right here. So here's a list of words that people say at the beginning of these types of conversations that like screw them until the end. Here they are. Deserve, should, fair, expect, demand, must, earn, insist, right, have, they, own. Like these are words that trip us up before we even start. So if you have to write a book, do you have to write a book like because Jane said you did or because the board of NSA?
Yes.
because whoever the current NSA president says you have to have a book. Like, no, you don't have to do anything. You're a grown up. So like that's the first thing. Let me just get that out of my system. But let's say you do have to write a book. Okay, great. So you're on the road speaking. Well, first of all, congratulations because there's a lot of people who aren't fortunate enough to be out there getting paid.
To have that problem, yes.
So what a great problem to have. I want you to think about it positively from that standpoint. And then, well, if you're out there speaking so much, well, wow, it sounds like you already are writing every time you're on stage, but maybe you're just not documenting. So perhaps a $50 purchase of an MP3 recorder could document all of your speeches. You can use my favorite resource, which is called Temi, T-E-M-I, Temi.com, which is the 10 cent a minute machine learning transcription service. Upload it to Temi. And then when you get back home on Friday afternoon after a week of speaking, you look at all your transcriptions and the writing is done. You just have to edit it. That is one workaround to the excuse of not writing. There are people that still isn't going to do it. And that's okay too, because I have colleagues that have been working on their book for 15 years. It literally is never going to happen, and it's okay. I have empathy for them. Again, there's no writing police that's going to get you in trouble. So like back to that original assumption, maybe like a book isn't your thing, and that's okay.
Yes, I think people will have to pick what medium is going to work best for them. I do have clients who they're so good at writing, and they can find the time. They can carve out the time. It's just not happening. Totally. And that actually leads us to one of the other excuses, is that whole not good enough syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
You know, thinking that your stuff, why would anybody care? Why would anybody want to read this?
Yeah, and I get that. You know, we all struggle with that. Anyone who's been in on stage or on a page or in front of people has the imposter syndrome. And so I get that. And, you know, that's something that people have to work out on their own. I mean, worthiness is like the core psychological need we all struggle with. So I have no insight on that, but here's what I can share. That insight about the word is assuming that it's important that everybody reads your stuff. So think of it this way, okay? I've written 36 books. Half of those, nobody has ever read. No, I literally look at the numbers. No one's bought them. No one gives a shit. And that's okay. And the reason is because I love writing. I do it for me. I do it because it grows my portfolio and the value that I bring to the world. So if I had only written 5 books because I was afraid nobody would read them, well, that versus the guy who's written 36 books, no one cares that no one's read my 36 books. They just care that I wrote them.
Right.
So I do it because it brings me joy and because it's useful in the world. And I've just surrendered to the fact that most people don't know who I am. The people that do know who I am haven't read my books. The people that have read my books haven't finished them. The people that finished my don't really care. People who do care aren't going to email me. And the people who do email me are just going to say, hey, there's a typo on page 186. So like, we just need to have some humility in the process and just surrender this need for everybody in the world to hear our stuff, and do it because it's useful to you, and do it because it grows your business, and do it because you'll be glad you did.
Okay. So the 36 books, I'm just curious. This is a little squirrel hole that we're going to go down here. What has been your most profitable book?
I have no idea. And the reason is because I give away most of my books for free. They're downloadable on the internet. I never kept track of sales. I had books stolen. I lost books in the fire. I don't know. Who cares?
I'm curious. I was just curious. I figured you would have had one that was like your front runner, the one that everybody wants as a part of it, an audience gift or something like that.
I don't sell them in the back of the room anymore, so they don't really get a choice. I have a book, it's called The Name Tag Principle. I have that book that I use like for events. Mm-hmm. If I do an event and there's 100 people and it's part of the package where everybody gets a book, I picked that one because it has a blank name tag on the cover, which means I can write something goofy on it. So like, that's just the most joy for that particular book. I mean, I wrote the book when I was 30 years old. So there are things I've learned since then that I think are better. So I don't know.
But you'll give that in the speech, right? So you can.
Yeah, it looks cool. It's a daily devotional, which means it's 366 days. Like all my books are like that, but that was like, you know, I really did a good job on that one. I gotta say, but profit, yeah, I don't know.
See, the business side of me is just like, ah, what? Yeah, anyway, that's okay. We're talking here about content creation, and I hope that,
That's important. I'm not a great business person. People should know that. Okay, I'm a writer. I'm a writer who knows how to be an entrepreneur, but I'm not a great business person, which is why I got burnt out and got a job at a startup so I can just make stuff on my free time. So that's like funny. People don't, if you really are into business and you want to grow it, like then you should definitely not take my advice at all. I don't measure shit.
Well, we're talking about content creation, and right, you do right. know how to create content, and I just feel like we just qualified that quite nicely, actually.
Yeah, yeah,
so
for
that's
sure.
good. All right. So what do you think the mistakes people make around their content might be?
Frequency, I would say, is a big mistake, meaning not enough.
Right. Or infrequency in terms of if right. you're posting a blog or something like that.
Yeah. It's hard to tie yourself to a schedule, and I understand discipline is difficult when it comes to something like that. So I started playing guitar when I was 12 years old, and my teacher told me it is better to practice 5 minutes a day every day than to play 5 hours on Saturday.
That's good advice.
And that's the incrementalism that I talked about before. So better to write, you know, a 300 word blog post every day or 3 days a week than to try to like go for the, you know, the goal on Friday with a 2000 word post because SEO is better because it's 2000 words. Like, I think the frequency is something where people mess up. That's my first one. Should I pick another mistake?
Sure.
Oh, I don't know. Mistakes writers make. Okay, so this goes back to our original topic about picking a lane, mm-hmm. which is being afraid to write about something that is like off brand. Like, oh no, like I can't write about this. I have the sales bug. If I write something about like leadership, like I'm going to get in trouble. So I think that it's important that people allow themselves to write about whatever they want. To write about something really personal, or to get really angry, or to get really sad, or to be sappy or cheesy or corny. Like, I love doing that. And just allow yourself to do it. Like, just remember, nobody's reading it anyway, so you may as well have fun with it. Remember, humility.
I love the humility part. I'm not sure about the nobody's reading it anyway part. At least I hope that's not true for some people, including myself.
It's not whether it's true. It's how that affects your process.
Yeah. And I think if you come at it from the perspective of, oh, well, I'll just put this out there because nobody's reading right. it anyway, it just doesn't matter. I'm just going to. But I would like for my clients who are business people to connect the dots back to what they're being talked about. And I get that you're a content creation guy, and I think we'll just agree to disagree on what all the topic genres should be. And maybe sure. maybe you'll open people up to write about things that maybe are more personal than they right. might have. And I love nothing more than a personal story that has a business application that is in surrounding their lane. So I like to connect the dots, okay?
I agree.
Okay, cool. All right, so let's talk about collaboration.
Okay.
How have you used collaboration to your benefit, and what might that look like for you?
Well, for me, the best collaborator I ever had and still have is a guy named Jeff Brown, and he runs a company in St. Louis called Trifecta Creative. He's my art director, and not my designer. That's a different thing. I think when we started, he was my graphic designer, but as our relationship developed, I thought, oh, wow, he's my art director. Every book I've done, every project, every website, every logo, everything I've done, he has amplified and elevated and branded and made professional under my creative direction. So the best thing I ever did was find this guy that I love and trust. Mm. And I can say, Jeff, I have a great idea. It's a game show. It's called Steal Scott's Ideas. We got to bring this thing alive. Go for it. And then I hear from him a week and a half later, and he just sends me a bunch of stuff. And it brings stuff to life. And I think it's important for creative people to have people that not only have different skill sets, like, you know, design, which I don't have, but people that can take your brand to a new level and take your ideas and make them big enough where it builds momentum.
Love it.
Started the game show a couple years ago. Before it was a game show, it was just an idea. But because Jeff made a logo and because he helped me kind of build it out with these devices, these visual, you know, representations of what my dream was, it made me want to make it come true. So that partnership, I think, is really important just because it visualizes what is otherwise like words and in your brain. So find a good art director. Find someone that has that other side of, you know, the skill set for you, because your ideas, they become more real.
I love that. And I think that I'm such a visual person that I actually need to see the cover of the book before I can even start writing the book. Yeah. A lot of people wait until the very end. And I'm like, oh, how could you wait? But I think that it's just a part of the process, right? Everybody has their own process.
Yeah, I think the cover is usually the first thing, the last thing to do.
Yeah.
That experience, that's what I've seen a lot. Either you have it in your head, you do it. Like, I'm writing a book for my startup. I'm pretty excited. It's a marketing book. And Jeff, who I just mentioned, is already doing the cover. The book hasn't even started, but I know we're going to do it. And I know that my team of 15 people, when they see the book cover, they're going to be like, oh, this is going to be awesome. So I think it works in that way. Or sometimes you don't know what the book is until you're done with it.
Yeah.
And then when you finish it, you're like, oh, okay, now I can do the cover. So I think it's either beginning or end, in my opinion.
That's fun. Tell us a bit more about the startup. I'm just curious about that.
Yeah. So, since 2012, I've been working full-time at a bunch of different places. I started my record company in 1999, started writing books in 2001. So I've been doing this for quite a while and just got burnt out and bored and just done with it all. So worked for a startup last year, and then now work for a new startup. Hang on. Can you still hear me? I'm getting an unstable connection.
Yeah, me too. I'll apologize to our listeners. It's a Wi-Fi issue today, even though we're hardwired.
It's a Wi-Fi. Okay. So, the startup I work for, it's really great. So a lot of our clients, or most of our clients, are retail and e-commerce company. Mm-hmm. So they're selling clothes or accessories, and our job is to build out performance marketing programs with paid search, paid advertising, email, marketing automation to help their brands grow. And now, I'm not client-facing like a lot of the account people are, but as a startup, my job is to help grow our brand, you know, work on our value system and deploying that and getting a sense of our philosophy and editorializing that throughout the industry, because what we do is really special and really different, and it's cool to be able to take everything building my own companies now and use it for the Metric Collective, which we are here, and it's super satisfying.
That's really fun. How much would you say that you need to build story into the content of, you know, what you're selling or to what you're doing in your daily job?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, so last week I was interviewing one of our account managers just to talk about his strategy for his e-commerce clients. And what he talks about is, you know, it's not just like running Facebook advertising to like boost sales. This is about building an overarching campaign narrative, which is a marketing performance term, but this is the same thing all of us can be thinking about. It's even the product description on the Shopify store telling everything we do is structured in a way where this isn't me selling single mothers a handbag because it's really convenient. This is about saying, hey, you live a particular type of life, and like this product, we want to be part of that. And so we're going to join you in your lifestyle, and this is the stuff we sell, and we think that'll match up. That's just a different approach that we take to marketing, and it works really well.
I love that term, campaign narrative.
Yeah, right.
You know, thinking about what that whole, what is it that you're really trying to say? And certainly that's something that, I work harder at in terms of the social media coming out of this office to create a narrative. And honestly, I don't think I've nailed it yet, and I'm hoping to turn a corner on that here shortly.
Well, I mean, the example I can think of, Jane, when you came to NSA St. Louis in 2011, maybe, the way I really loved the way that you presented, you said that you had just finished a speech where you got a standing ovation, you got in your limo back to the airport, you got a text message that said you closed another speech, and like you built this whole story, and that was my favorite part of that talk, as I thought, like you're building this vision of like where you want to go to. And I mean, if that's not a narrative, I don't know what.
You know, that's interesting that you say that. That's been how I've been opening my presentations now for years.
Yeah, and I love it.
I would say that my least favorite of my own presentations, I didn't do that. I tried to change it up to something else. And I missed it so much because I feel like that's what people really glom onto. And so I recognized that. And even the day later, I went back to my old standby. It still works. You know, when you get an opening that really, really works and captures people. And you remember that. How long ago was that?
It was 7 years ago.
7 years ago, and you still remembered it. And so, and it's in the front of the book too. So I think that maybe that is my campaign narrative. Maybe that's what we need to build everything that we are going forward around. That's good.
It's powerful.
I got my price of admission to this podcast. Thank you very much, Scott Kinsberg.
No charge.
That's cool. All right. So if we're trying to be kind of, let's just look back over the course of all of the things that you have created. All the books, albums, articles, speeches, videos, software applications. What have been like a couple of lessons that you've learned along the way? Was there anything that you did that you thought, oh my goodness, I am never doing that again?
I'm not sure I said I'm never doing this again, but I can share the biggest failure.
Okay.
And the biggest waste, not waste, but the biggest like misuse of money. So in 2006-07, I built a program called Tag TV, which was an online training website. And this is like before YouTube was a big thing.
Yeah.
But you know, I built a studio, green screen, you know, Adobe Premiere, like camera, the whole lights, all the deal. Built the whole studio, took lessons, learned how to use the entire Adobe Creative Suite for editing video and camera, et cetera, et cetera. Learned how to read teleprompter, built these really great videos for what they were and for where I was, like was really proud of them. I worked really hard. I spent about $15,000, which at the time I was actually making a lot, so it was okay to do that. Can't imagine doing that now, but because it's so cheap now to do video. Back then, video was very expensive.
Yes,
and I was like, oh, you know what, YouTube, that's never going to work out. I'm just going to get people to my site. Who would go to YouTube to watch someone talk on a camera? So I tried to like out YouTube, and the product was great. I was really proud of it. I had one client that ultimately paid for video modules and a whole learning program I did. And that pretty much broke even on the cost. So that was worthwhile in terms of like economically, but overall, like no one cared. It was just a failure in terms of didn't go anywhere. It didn't grow anything with it. Eventually shut the website down, got rid of the studio. I had a whole computer system and a Canon GL2 that I spent $3,000 on that was just like sitting there. This is before iPhones. So, you know, it was, so I'm starting to like feel shame just thinking about how much I spent on that. But it did teach me how to produce video and how to speak on prompter and how to create learning modules and do training. And I learned the Adobe Creative Suite, which has now served me in a lot of ways. Like my last job last year, I started doing videos just like NameTag TV, but for my European startup, like same structure. And that was really great on social and really helped our product team. So like I was able to use all the skills that I learned, but overall, like, yeah, that pretty much bombed.
You know, and we've all had situations like that, and there are lessons there. And there's a lesson that I learned last week, and you know, I don't know, Scott, if it would be applicable to anything that you're doing, but it might make you think about it. Rather than adding more and more and more layers, it's the idea is that you go back to one or two of your offerings and you go and do deep dives on those. And I've been thinking, you know, I look at your list of accomplishments and I think, wow, he's done all these things. But then I look at my list of all of the offerings that we have and I think, no. And actually, two of the things that I'm going to do deep dive on our my book, The Wealthy Speaker 2.0, because it's still relevant, it's still valid, and I want it's still the gateway to bring in new clients. And my journal, I just did a daily success planner and journal, and I want to do deep dive on those.
Awesome.
And like, I haven't done all the due diligence to really be selling those properly. And so I think for those who are listening in thinking, I need to do more, 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 I would also have you look at what do you need to do a deep dive on and really try to earn some money from something that you've already developed.
Yeah, I think that's the right approach. I think if I were a business person, that's the approach I would take. I think if I was, if I had not retired from doing this full time, like I would absolutely do that. My brain just, I'm not a rear view mirror kind of guy. I'm just like, my next six books are already done. So why would I go back and redo power to build and have learned that I think are better? I'm more interested in putting out the new stuff.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, listen, Scott, I have love. We've known each other probably for 15 or close to 20 years. And I love getting to know you again and seeing what and hearing what you're up to. I mean, I think your story is really interesting. Before we let you go, tell us a little bit about that burnout piece that drove you to say, you know what, this is not what I'm going to do anymore. You came off the road from speaking.
I came off everything. Yeah. It was May 15th of 2012. I was eating peanut butter, chocolate, cookie dough, ice cream. And I just had coffee with a friend of mine, and I was just, something was wrong. And it had been building for several months at the time, but I was like, I think I'm done. I don't think I want to do any of this anymore. And I can't explain what that felt like. I just had this strange premonition, and this was on a Friday. So the weekend, the whole weekend I spent on my porch because it was May. It was nice outside. I just sat on the porch and wrote a letter of resignation to myself. And it was about a 10-page letter to myself of everything I was feeling. And I was just letting go of everything and why I didn't need to do this and just coming to terms with this, like, I think I did it. Like, I won. I think I'm good. Like, it doesn't mean I'm never going to do anything again, but like, I think I need to let this go. I think I had my moment, and it's time to like try some new stuff and move on. And that weekend, like, I felt like I lost 100 pounds.
Wow.
And it was this unbelievable, like, lightness of being, this very euphoric sense that the only time I ever remember feeling that way, the week after I graduated college, because of this like freedom and possibility, that whatever that feeling is called. And it was really beautiful. And I remember came home from ice cream. I said to my wife, I think I'm going to quit my job. And she's like, okay, cool. So that began a process of reinvention that is still continuing, but took some time to do. And so that was May. I took the entire summer off, didn't write a single thing, went on vacation with my family to Alaska and to Mexico, and then came back in August and started, like, I had to write a resume, which I had never done, and just started looking for jobs. And okay, I guess I'm going to go join the workforce now, and got a job pretty quickly at an agency and worked there for a while. And then, you know, did a bunch of other stuff and kind of went back and forth. But like, I mean, that was 2012, so that was quite a while ago. But since then, like, I use this, or but not, I'm a doosan. That's the term that I use. So I have a full time job.
Say it again, because you blanked on me.
I'm a dual citizen.
Oh, okay.
So I have a full time job,
yeah.
And then on my own free time, I write books and do other projects and do whatever I feel like doing, not because I need to or because my business requires me to, but because I want to. And so it's like, it comes from a place of joy. So, you know, this year in 2018, I have two paid speeches. That's my speaking calendar. I already gave one and I got one more later. Two paid speeches. And for the record, I doubled my speaking calendar from last year.
I love it.
And So I've never been speaking less, and I've never been writing more, and I've never been more happier and more fulfilled, because I had to let go of what was no longer serving me and just be okay with that. And it was very difficult and took a long time to work through all of that panic. Came out on the other side in a really beautiful place. And I don't know what will happen for the rest of my career, but like, just the idea of having to travel once a week to go give a talk in the middle of Indiana, like, I'm good. Like, I've done, I already won. I did it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. But you don't forget that most people come out of college and go to the corporate job and do that for 20 years and then do this. So you did everything in complete reverse order.
Oh, yeah.
And what I'm glad for is that I know you got some cosmic 2x4s upside the head in terms of your health.
Sure.
But I'm really glad that it didn't take, I was worried that we, when you said that day in May, that it was going to be something happened to you. And I'm really glad that it didn't get to that. I'm sure your health has gotten a lot better since then, hey?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's, I mean, relaxing is a skill. So.
Yeah, and workaholic was definitely your middle name at that point in time, was it not?
For a long time, yeah. I had to come to terms like, oh, this is actually an addiction. Good to know.
Well, Scott, thank you so much. I'm glad you shared that with us, because not everybody is going to do this for the next 20 or 30 years. And I want to, you know, note that you really did go about it a little bit ass backwards, but that's I love that you're where you've landed today, and congratulations on all of your success and getting this bliss in life, and you know, going ahead, you're probably heading off to the yoga studio at some point here today, are you?
I'll be there after tonight.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today. And with that, we'll say see you soon, wealthy speakers. Bye for now, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Wealthy Speaker Show. Please visit speakerlauncher.com for your free Wealthy Speaker audit, and visit speakerlauncher.com/podcast for show notes and many more resources to help you catapult your speaking business. See you soon, wealthy speakers.